Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the February 13th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. And we have a really full agenda today, so we're going to start as a subcommittee, and I'm sure that our other three members will be here imminently. And so we're going to take basically the things that we have under the informational meeting first, and that's what we had agreed to do. So we will start by opening an informational meeting on executive appointments, and I'll ask, I guess, all three of you to come forward. Was that your plan?
Sure. We didn't have one yet.
Well, now we've got one. So I think what this is meant to be is an initial overview and discussion about our executive appointments process, which is part of a major part of the workload of this committee. And then along with that, we're going to have, I think, a high-level overview of an audit that was done by the Secretary of State's office on the whole subject of boards and commissions. So I don't know which of you was planning to start off, but I assume it would be Kendall Klassen from the Governor's office?
Yes. Well, good morning. For the record, my name is Kendall Klassen. I'm Director of Executive Appointments for Governor Kitzhaber. Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Starr, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you about our process at Executive Appointments. I wanted to welcome Senator Starr. I look forward to working with you throughout the course of our time together. And then also to, for the record, acknowledge the great work that this committee does. We work in partnership very well. It's exciting to have an opportunity to work with people who do significant amount of our due diligence, so I appreciate that. I thought that I would start out by just giving you sort of a landscape of the executive appointments process, a little bit of detail about what it means to participate, and some of the things that we're looking for. Good morning, Senator Beyer. Our office with executive appointments has two full-time employees, myself and an administrative assistant. We break up our duties based on our primary responsibilities. So I take a leadership role over most of the recruitment efforts, the vetting, legislative relationships, relationships with the governor, having discussions with outside organizations like associations, lobby, etc., to help identify really great candidates to serve on our boards and commissions. My administrative assistant is responsible for all of the paperwork that's associated with this process. He manages all of the rosters, communicates with all of the board administrators, provides them with whatever information that they need to operate their boards and interface with their new and current members, and he also prepares all of our submissions to the Senate Secretary and to the Senate Rules Committee. We are working with a pretty large system of volunteer-based HR. If I were to describe it, that's pretty much how we work. So these are largely non-paid volunteer support team people for the state. What we know right now is that there are approximately a total of 312 boards, commissions, task forces, and work groups. 230 of them, approximately, are boards and commissions. There are 82 task forces and work groups. There are 28 agency directors that we're responsible for appointing. 106 of those boards require Senate confirmation, and 124 do not. So in the time, in addition to the work that we're doing with the Senate side of our boards, the boards that require Senate confirmation, we are consistently throughout the year appointing members that do not require Senate confirmation. So despite the timing of the calendar year, we are working all year round to keep filling spots and putting people onto boards. One highlight that I did want to note is that of the appointments that were made from the time that Governor Kitzhaber came back into office in 2011, we have made nearly 1,000 appointments in that two-year period, and half of those have been those that have come in front of you for Senate confirmation. The average size of a board that we're working with is 9 members. We do have a handful of boards that are on this side of the spectrum that have as small a number as 3 members, and then on this side of the spectrum as many as 25. At any time, we may find ourselves having to rotate someone in or out of those seats, depending on people's life circumstances or their ability to continue serving. So because we make appointments on a particular board doesn't mean that that board is done, boxed up, and put away. We're constantly interfacing with every single one of the boards that we're working with. Each board has a different responsibility. They can be anything from a policy board, an advisory board, a licensing board, a judgment board, or a governing board. In terms of our recruitment process, again, I have the lion's share of the responsibility for working with our team of policy advisors in the governor's office. Each one is out in the world working within their policy area, so they're great helpers in helping us identify people who are in their spectrum that would be great to serve on these boards. The percentage, though, of names that we receive from our policy advisors are probably about 30%, and then I do the rest of them. So we reach out everywhere. One of the things that we have changed in this process is not just assuming that only the people who know about these opportunities are the ones that we should select from. We've changed our way of working where we're operating much more like headhunters, where we're interfacing with associations, corporate relationships, small businesses, community-based organizations, literally looking in every part of the state that we can find great quality people to serve on these boards. So it takes a little bit more time on the front end, but we found that we have a greater success rate in keeping people on the boards if we do our due diligence far more in the front part. Our application process is relatively simple. There's a 3-page application that I think all of you are familiar with. It's 2 pages of information and 1 page on that has a background process. We have a pretty intensive background check with the OSP and also with the Department of Revenue. Typically, you don't see any of that. That's a way for us to measure someone's competence in participating. So if for some reason there's a challenge with someone, say, with the Department of Revenue, we will not move that person forward until that's squared away. We want you to be in good standing with the state if you're going to participate with the state. In terms of vetting, we spend a significant amount of time discussing people's basic core competence. What are the skills that they have? What are their personal attributes that are helpful to this process? We not only want people to have really strong and comprehensive resumes, but we also want them to be really good citizens, people who are committed to the work of the state, who will make that commitment to 4 and hopefully 8 years of a term and stick. It's not helpful for any of us to have to go through this relatively intensive process of appointing people to only have them fall off if we haven't done enough of our due diligence in the beginning. Spend time with state agencies, the board administrators, really trying to get a very clear picture of what's required of people. I will know what I know on my end of things. A lot of that is through paper, and that can be very attractive. But we're looking for the people who know these folks really well to weigh in on how successful they'll be. We also have begun to do social media reviews. We're finding that it's helpful for us to see how people are presenting themselves in their lives outside of their work. If there's anything that could potentially be a conflict, we are also looking in those arenas. And then finally, in terms of the submission process, we submit our names to the Senate Secretary 21 days in advance of the Rules Committee hearing. By the time the Senate Senate Secretary receives that. We're hoping that we've done as intensive of a vetting process as we possibly can so that, again, we don't face challenges when they reach your hands. We have established a really great partnership with the Senate Secretary's office and the Rules Committee administrators who have been very supportive in helping us get all of the pieces pulled together for making sure that we get our folks in front of you appropriately. And then we communicate constantly as a team with all of the potential candidates prior to their arrival here. So that's the overview of the executive appointments process. I'll happily take questions or wait until my partners complete their side of things. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Kendall. And members, I just have on the way to you a letter that was prepared that describes the process in more detail that Kendall prepared and sent to the chair of the committee. So I think that'll be helpful when you see it. And it actually shows that we have three proposed dates to do executive appointments during this legislative session, the first one of which is going to be a floor session on March 6th. So today, as a matter of fact, by no particular design, is the deadline for submission of the first batch of names, so that will be forthcoming by close of business today. So if you have any questions, and I know most of the members are very familiar with how this process works, but please, I think Kendall's always available to answer questions. And I'll just remind people, as I told you at the beginning of our work this session, that Aaron Seiler, who currently staffs House Rules, is still staffing the executive appointments function of this committee, so as to ensure continuity and organization. And so we're very lucky to have her still working with Lori Brecker to do that. Okay, so I think maybe we'll just move right along, since we've got so much to talk about, into the Secretary of State audit.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, Kate Brown, currently serving as Oregon Secretary of State. To my right is Gary Blackmer, my chief auditor, and we're here this morning to talk a little bit about an audit we completed on Oregon's boards and commissions. In my first term, we completed a few audits on some particular boards and commissions, and as a result of the concerns that we found, we decided to take a look at the overall boards and commissions structure. I think it's fair to say since the late 1800s, the number of boards and commissions in the state of Oregon has been a concern for the state executive. I share with you a quote from Governor William Lord in 1897, and if you'd like a little more information about Governor Lord, you can go on our archive site and find extensive historical information about him. But I'll just share, a board is a mischievous administrative instrumentality because its effect is to divide responsibility, destroy the symmetry of our governmental system, trench on the prerogatives of the executive, and injuriously affect the management of the institutions. To avoid further enumeration in detail, I earnestly recommend that you abolish all boards, commissions, and offices that do not serve a useful public purpose and thus cut off the unnecessary expense of their longer continuance. Please be aware that when Governor Lord was governor, I believe there are 16 boards and commissions. I believe every governor between Governor Lord and Governor Hatfield attempted, but Governor Hatfield attempted a major restructuring. I don't think we have the quote for you on our slide, but it's in the audit. Another comment I wanted to share about governor's attempts is that in 1997, the legislature managed successfully to eliminate three boards and commissions. At that time, the legislature, of which I was a part, created a sunset committee, and the goal of the sunset committee was to determine what boards and commissions should have sunset clauses. Unfortunately, the sunset committee had a sunset clause and was shut down before it accomplished its mission. Yes, Senator Starr, I am not kidding. In terms of our audit, which we completed last year, we found several consistent themes over the 290 boards and commissions and active task forces, but this morning I'd highlight two of them for you. First is a lack of accountability, and second, a lack of transparency. In terms of accountability, the Commission for the Blind, I think, is a good example. Its mission is to assist Oregonians who are blind or visually impaired in making informed choices and decisions to achieve full inclusion and integration in society through employment, independent living, and social self-sufficiency. Our 2011 audit found that the Blind Commission spent $3,500 for drying and bone braces, $56 on student pedicures, and that staff also took a bicycle trip to the San Juan Islands with clients, former clients, and relatives. This clearly was a pattern of fiscal irresponsibility. There are lots of examples of boards and commissions that are not held accountable for public spending, spending public money appropriately. I think this is a flaw in our system, and it needs to be addressed. Secondly, I mentioned transparency. We discovered boards that hardly anyone knew existed, boards with no websites, making decisions that folks were not aware of. One example is the Oregon Travel Experience. It's a little-known agency that oversees rest stops and other secondary transportation programs. Our audit revealed that the head of the agency secretly retired in 2011. That's right. She kept her retirement secret from the full board for more than a year. My point is that you fundamentally cannot have accountability without basic transparency. In terms of moving forward, we made a number of recommendations in the audit. This morning, I'd like to highlight two of them. We would like to prioritize an audit of licensing boards because of the potential health and safety risks for Oregonians. We're most concerned about these boards because they license professionals. Not only do they manage state employees, but they make sure that only qualified people are working in critical professions. For the first time ever that we are aware of, we will be conducting an audit of these licensing boards, and we'll make recommendations to make certain that they are both held accountable and are transparent. The other recommendation we have impacts proliferation. Despite near universal agreement that we have too many boards and commissions, their numbers continue to grow like that invasive species we are so fond of, Scotch broom. This very body created during the last legislative session 11 new boards and commissions. So this is not a problem just here in Oregon. It's a problem across the country. One of the wonderful things I think about our auditing techniques is that we take a look at best practices across the rest of the country. And in our audit, we include several recommendations about including both sunrise and sunset provisions to make sure that we can control the proliferation of boards and commissions. So with that, I will conclude. I'm more than happy to answer any questions or concerns. Our audits are available online, so you can go this morning when you have time. I know you have very busy schedules, but put in either the particular agency search or the year search and pull up the particular audit that you are interested in. So thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here in front of you today.
Thank you, Secretary Brown, and I want to just mention for members that the entire audit was posted and is posted on OLIS, so if you want to read it in its entirety, and I highly recommend it to you for bedtime reading, it's all there. But the executive summary, all you would have to read is about the first probably 10 or 12 pages, and you'd get to the recommendations pretty quickly.
Madam Chair, on this particular audit, I have to say I thought the Audits Division did a terrific job pulling in Oregon history.
So at this point, we have also the head of the Audits Division, Gary Blackburn. Did you have anything you wanted to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just here for any questions.
Great. Well, thank you for being here. So did we, I apologize to the members who weren't able to join us when we started, but this is meant to be both an overview of the executive appointments process as this committee operates and then a very brief summary of the audit. So any questions from committee members?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Starr.
Ms. Clausen, you mentioned in your review of the potential candidates for various commissions, you mentioned social media reviews. Can you just talk a little bit about that? That's a topic of some conversation in this legislative session.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, yes, the notion of social media reviews, we don't use that as a means of throwing people out of the process, but really trying to get a sense of ways in which their lives are spread out across Oregon. There are a lot of things that are really interesting about people that we may not hear about in the two pages that they get to write in their application. We've learned about writings that people have submitted. There are things that people have done in their personal lives that are fascinating in terms of their volunteerism in other arenas, so it helps us get a greater understanding. We've had a couple of occasions where some things have come up that have given us pause about whether or not a person would be appropriate for a particular board. I'm always taking in consideration whether or not we have to be concerned about behavioral things that could be embarrassing to this legislative body or to the governor or to the state itself. And all of those things are in consideration. So in the same way that if someone were applying for a job, we want to know about all of those things that would affect our company or our business or, in this case, the state.
And I think I know where Senator Starr is coming from with this question, because I've recently looked at legislation that was introduced to outlaw a requirement that people have to provide private passwords as part of a screening process. I think that applies in employment situations. I didn't read it closely enough to know if it applies for things like volunteer positions, but I would assume that you're not requiring people to provide private passwords for things that aren't publicly available. And also, just to further clarify that, I think, you know, this arises because sometimes members of the committee are also looking at these applicants and not just at their official application, but just sort of looking at them as people. So I think questions have arisen, even in the short time I've chaired this committee, about things that came about through various sources. So I can see why you would be sort of making people mindful of that. I guess my question, and maybe this is to the Secretary, is about this idea of sunsetting everything, because it certainly is extremely time-consuming for everybody involved to make sure, and I think Kendall probably more than anyone, to make sure that people are appropriately trained, are duly qualified for these positions, and then for this committee to be able to play our role in the ones that require Senate confirmation. So how would, if there were a sunsetting approach taken, again, how would you see that working into the workload that the legislature has otherwise? Because I wasn't aware that there had been a sunset commission when you were in this body.
Madam Chair, the audit takes a look at a number of different states. One of the examples that I thought was most effective probably was the state of Washington, and they had a series of questions that they asked each board and commission prior to the sunset to determine its effectiveness. So that is one approach. There are a number of approaches out there in terms of doing it. And one way would, frankly, to have the committee review. Another way would maybe to appoint a subcommittee. An actual subcommittee of the boards and commissions, not a new subcommittee. So there are a number of ways to do it. I don't know if Gary wants to add anything.
Madam Chair, one other state has used sunrise requirements that with 300-plus boards, someone is probably doing something very similar already, and merely assigning that new responsibility to an existing board can avoid creating another one. And so they have a series of questions that they ask before a board or commission is created.
Okay, interesting ideas. And there is legislation this session. Not all of it is in this committee to, I think, begin the process of consolidation and trying to streamline some of these functions. So we'll get a chance, presumably, to hear about that discussion later on in session. Yes, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we do credit reports?
Madam Chair, Senator Fairley, no, we don't.
Okay. So we're probably the only entity in the world that doesn't, then. If that's the case. Madam Chair, just an observation. I certainly understand the difficulty, ponderousness of the number of boards and commissions, but I sort of regard this as I do with tax expenditure limitation. You know, we've given tax credits, and every couple of years we get, in trouble financially and haul out the book and look at tax credits with the idea that we're going to eliminate them. And after a rigorous shakeout of all the unnecessary tax credits, we keep them all. With boards and commissions, we're really grateful that Oregonians will step forward and pick up the burden of self-governance, which is what these boards and commissions do. And I wonder if the commissions disappeared or we decided to streamline their activities, how much of the problems that they get together and solve would end up in this building. So, you know, I look at the boards and commissions in two or three different ways. First of all, it's an opportunity for ordinary citizens to do direct participation in governance. That is probably the greatest value. The other thing is it decentralizes authority. And one of our huge problems is the clear impression that most decisions are already made, and they're already made on the I-5 corridor. But if you look at the boards and commissions, they decentralize authority to every corner of Oregon. And that's a critical piece of participatory government. So I really think that's a valuable piece. Of course, the other thing is, I know it's inconvenient for us in the system and in the bureaucracy to manage all these things. Democracy is inconvenient. It is. But getting rid of these boards and commissions may deprive us of the kind of input we need, the kind of decentralization that Oregonians really cherish, and the kind of participatory government that makes better citizens. So getting rid of boards and commissions sounds like a great idea. Might save a few pennies, you know, in the bigger billion-dollar scale. It isn't very much money. But it might sacrifice a number of really valuable aspects that if we didn't have the board and commission system, we'd have to go create one. So that's my two cents, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli. I don't know if anybody wanted to comment on that. I would just mention, though, because of the idea about doing credit reports, that this legislature specifically passed a law in 2010 that prohibits credit reports being used for employment purposes except in some narrowly defined cases. So I hope that it isn't true that everybody in Oregon is doing credit reports, because they would be breaking the law. So,
Madam Chairman, I wish we could do the same thing for people who'd like to buy car insurance.
Well, there's still time to introduce bills for this session.
Ready? Aye.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I think you raise a really good point about our boards and commissions. It's an opportunity for citizens to participate in policy making. I think one of the challenges is making sure that citizens from all across Oregon are able to participate. I chair a board on behalf of the governor, and we've worked really hard to make sure that there are rural participants actively participating on the board. I think one of them is your constituent, former Chair Mark Webb, and it's really a challenge, but I do think technology has been a friend in terms of making sure that voices from throughout Oregon can be heard on these boards. The other thing I would say is that under Ms. Clausen's leadership, the executive appointments have done a really good job reaching out to all the corners of Oregon, really ensuring that there's a diversity of voices at the table, and I think that's critically important.
Thank you. Senator Starr.
Thank you very much. So I'm looking at your audit online, and it's interesting. I've had the distinct privilege and opportunity over the last year to travel around the state and listen to a lot of Oregonians, and I campaigned with a friend of mine who had some things to say about the audit division, and listened to Oregonians talk. And one of the things that I heard a lot was, we have audits that get done, but nobody sees them. Nobody pays attention to them. And as I look at the recommendations here, the recommendations aren't about eliminating boards and commissions, but a number of things here that I think are really important. What kinds of actions can you as the Secretary of State take to implement the recommendations? Have you recommended legislation? Is that necessary? Have you taken the information here and shared it with the heads of the various boards and commissions and said, hey, here's some fantastic recommendations about how you should organize yourself? Or have you thought about, you know, this list of things? Can you talk a little bit about, because that was a criticism, quite honestly, that we go through this expensive process, come up with recommendations, and what happens with that is it sits on a shelf or it's online, but who takes advantage of it?
Senator Starr, Madam Chair, I will answer your question broadly in terms of our audit reports. Generally speaking, agencies do a really good job implementing the recommendations of our audits. Our track record for the last year has been in the neighborhood of 80 to 85%. There are some additional tools that we have implemented to ensure that our audit recommendations are implemented. For example, we go in and do follow-up audits, and the Commission for the Blind report that we did in 2012 is a follow-up. Was it 2011 or 2012? 12 is a follow-up audit to see, ascertain how well the particular agency is complying with our recommendations. For example, in the Willamette Education Service District, we did multiple follow-up audits. I knew when staff at the Willamette Education Service District was calling our auditors to ask how they could comply with the recommendations, that we are doing a really good job. So that's one way, is the follow-up audits. The second way is during the interim, we had the joint legislative audits and information management technology committee. So when we complete a particular audit, we ask the committee that the auditee present how well they're doing in terms of complying with the recommendations to the committee. We may also present the audit as well. And then we're currently working with the co-chairs because I don't have a particular hammer, so to speak, to enforce the recommendations, but working with the co-chairs to weave our audit presentations in terms of our recommendations into the agency budget presentations. Lastly, I'll just share a report. We're still working on it, so I should say draft form, but this is a list of our audit recommendations over the last couple of years and the agency response and where they are in compliance. I have to tell you, I think this report, the 61 pages, is not very useful to you as a legislator in this form, but the Legislative Fiscal Office has this, will have it sometime this morning. So we're hoping to get it to you in a form that's more readable and one that would hopefully keep you up at night as opposed to put you to sleep at night, which I think this particular one would do. But those are some of the things that we're doing to work to make sure that our audit recommendations are implemented. I also meet with the individual auditees in my office to encourage them to comply with recommendations. So, for example, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I had Erin Kelly Seal in my office talking about some of the audits that we had done of her agency, about my concerns in terms of the agency complying with those recommendations, and the fact that we were going to be issuing this particular report, and hopefully it would be an encouragement in terms of the agency implementing our recommendations. One of the challenges, frankly, in terms of agency recommendations is that sometimes they don't have the resources or that there's a statutory change. So the best example I can give of this is the Travel Experience Council. There was some statutory authority needed. I believe Senator Peter Courtney introduced legislation to make sure that they have that statutory authority that we recommended at Senate Bill 276, and I would really encourage you to pass it. So sometimes, yes, there is specific legislation. We encourage the agency heads to submit legislation that would enable them to implement our recommendations. So, Gary, do you want to add anything to my very long response?
I would just say that a lot of our recommendations have to do the inner workings and the management within the agencies, and a lot of times they don't get the high profile of attention, but they do make the agency work better, and with compliance we oftentimes get everyone happy with the audit, and that doesn't necessarily make news that the general Oregonian would hear. Conflict seems to be what generates news, and that happens occasionally as well, but not for every audit that we do.
Madam Chair, if I might, Senator Starr, the other thing to consider is that we naturally want to gravitate towards the extreme of let's hack away all of the boards and commissions when we know that that's not necessarily the most realistic answer. One of the things that I think that the Secretary of State and her audit division did an exceptional job around is highlighting things that we can do now to make things more efficient, reduce risk. I can give you the sense, this is a simple thing. Once my process is complete with executive appointments, our board members are basically handed over to the board administrator. We do not have training. We do not have an orientation that happens live and in person with anyone. Everyone is handed a membership handbook, and we have to hope and pray that they read it. So the way in which we generate resources, the way in which we set those expectations prior to reprimanding people for not being transparent or not operating in the way that we'd like them to, I think those are some of the ways in which we can address some of the issues without setting the whole house on fire.
Thank you. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Senator Starr, just a really specific example of how we work together on the particular audit for the boards and commissions. I mean, I don't think any of our recommendations, like you mentioned, say get rid of boards and commissions.
No, they don't.
We're really encouraging greater transparency and accountability in this particular audit. But one of our specific recommendations was that the governor's office work to compile and maintain a comprehensive listing of all boards and commissions, which we couldn't find that information as we were doing the audit. Ms. Clausen's office has already accomplished that particular recommendation. So on that one, they get an A+.
Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Secretary, I'm just curious, did you check the blue book?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe so, but I'll turn that question over to Mr. Blackmer.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, we did, as a matter of fact, and we found, by comparing all the different sources, we basically came up with 259, and then Ms. Clausen added on to that. So it was, for us, getting at least some enumeration to start with was worthwhile.
So you might have missed some in your editorial efforts. On a more serious note, I'm curious, I remember how those audits used to work when I was administering the PUC. Does the Secretary of State's office follow up in the Ways and Means process on serious audits? And I'm assuming that the Ways and Means committees, when they review, I'm trying to remember, but it seems like there was one was your response to audits. I'm curious if you follow up with Ways and Means at all.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, we're working with the Budget Committee chairs to make sure that when we make specific recommendations that the Budget Committees regarding a particular agency, that the particular Budget Committee that is dealing with that agency is aware of the issues or concerns that we have raised and the progress or lack of progress that the particular agency has made in meeting those recommendations. These are not intended as sort of gotcha, go after state mm-hmm. government. It's how can we do this more effectively and more efficiently? How can we make sure that we're getting the biggest bang for your taxpayer dollar? So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but we're working to kind of weave these into the budget presentations.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, if I could add, this report that we're going to be sending out this morning, for each recommendation, we have a status for it, and the categories are fully implemented or resolved, partially implemented in progress, partially implemented, no further action to be taken, not yet started, or declined to implement. And our hope is that it generates discussion among legislative committee members and the agencies on where they are on it, what more they could be doing, doing, what kind of obstacles they're encountering. And frankly, sometimes our recommendations are not the most burning priority an agency head has, and they're saying, we will get to it, but at this point, we have other more urgent things we need to address. And so just getting a commitment from an agency head that they that it is something they will follow through on from our standpoint is great progress.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any more questions or comments from committee members, so I think we will look forward, Kendall, to seeing you soon and seeing the list.
Very soon.
Of our next batch of executive appointments, and I think this is probably a discussion that will continue both in this committee and in other committees. So thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I will...
They're both on their way.
Ah, great. Okay. Committee members, I'll close this informational hearing. Thank you.
Yeah.
And committee members, stand at ease for just a moment. We have the legislative sponsors on their way to the hearing room on the next two items on our agenda, and then we will begin as soon as they get in the room. Committee will come back to order, and thank you, members, and I will open a public hearing and work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 7, and I see that we have Representative Frederick. I think our other legislative sponsor, Senator Shields, is testifying and will be with us soon. And then if you'd like to come forward, Rep. Frederick, and did you plan to bring people with you, or?
I was just going to speak. You've got a number of people in the back here.
Right.
But,
okay. Well, come forward and...
Making sure that I'm on the right one.
Yeah. So SCR 7 honors Charles Jordan for his visionary leadership.
Do you want
unfortunately,
to
for
reference
yes, I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's
the first,
all right, Madam Chair.
The first piece of legislation we've had. Have a seat, and we will let our capable committee administrator tell us what SCR 7 is.
That's fine. You've already noted, Madam Chair. That's. I will just add the information. SCR 7 does honor Charles Jordan for his visionary leadership and contributions to the City of Portland. Portland and people of Oregon. I wanted to especially note, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that there is a dash one amendment before you, behind the staff measure summary, and that simply adds a provision referencing the Charles Jordan Community Center. There is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact as introduced or on the dash one amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you very much, Lori. And now, please go ahead. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, committee. I appreciate being able to be in front of you. Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, I'm Representative Lou Frederick. I represent House District 43 in North and Northeast Portland. And frankly, it's hard for me to speak briefly about Charles Jordan. I could talk for quite a while. He's been a mentor, a guiding light, an example, and a very good example. Others can tell you about Charles's accomplishments. You probably have those within the the resolution itself. I have one story that no one else can probably tell. I invited Charles Jordan to my home to visit a group of fifth graders as part of a program I put on a few years ago. I had fifth graders come for 4 weeks, and 12 of them would come, and then I would get another group of 12, and I would have adults come and talk with them. You can steal this idea. Please do. It was a lot of fun. I had about 90 different folks who showed up in my room, in my living room, 90 different adults, and they would talk about being an adult. And it was a lot of fun. And the kids loved it as well. I invited Charles to come and visit as part of this program. And now, you know, Charles is tall. He's an awesome figure coming through the door to a 10-year-old or to any of us. I think he's 6'8". But he wasn't there to tell them about basketball. In fact, one of the things he told them is that he turned down the NBA twice. Instead, he talked about what he was working on, what he believed in, what was important to him as an adult in the community. And he listened to them. It was an impressive interaction, full of mutual respect, where both found the other interesting. And that's the kind of human being Charles is, personally, professionally, and with those he's just met. He's really quite an extraordinary man. So while honors like this one are generally about accomplishments, the more visible manifestations of brilliance, when I think of Charles Jordan, I think of the genius of the humanity at the core of this man. I thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and yes, as I said, I could talk at length about the way that Charles Jordan has managed to change this community and for the better. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative Frederick. Any questions?
Mm-hmm.
And we will, I wanted to just check in with you. We were planning to hear from other witnesses.
Great.
On this one. Are you pressed for time? Do you want to do your testimony on the other one, or can you wait?
No, if it will be helpful. I'm in another committee myself right now in Ways and Means, and I'm just learning how to deal with all of that.
Okay. So you would like
would
to
you
go
mind?
Ahead. Yes, absolutely. Let me also open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 8. And Lori, tell us what this is.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Concurrent Resolution 8 memorializes the life and the many contributions of Rob Ingram, who lived from 1973 until 2011. There is no additional amendment. There are no amendments, and there is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact on the measure as introduced.
Go ahead, Representative Frederick.
Thank you very much. And you do have members of his family in the back of behind me here, which is great. Thank you again, Chair Rosenbaum and the members of the committee. Do I need to reintroduce myself here? I will anyway. I'm Representative Lou Frederick, House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. Others are probably going to speak about the shock we all felt when Rob Ingram left us far too soon. I want to focus on the awe that I continue to feel for what he accomplished in his short life. It is fitting that we're considering these two resolutions today. Charles Jordan and Rob Ingram shared a genius for connecting with people, and both of them used that talent to make the world a better place. While others complained about disconnected youth, Rob made connections. Somehow he caused young people, particularly young black men, to care almost as much about their futures as he did, because he did. Somehow he helped police officers and city officials see the potential in young people seeking a place to belong and sometimes finding it in the wrong place. I'm afraid such ability is more art than science, more talent than training, more intuition than calculation. But along with his talent, he applied tireless work and a huge heart. We lost a true genius when that heart stopped. He was an incredible man. If you never got a chance to meet him, you really missed something. He was able to bring people together in ways that were not so serious all the time, and humorous, and yet made it a point everywhere. He's also better dressed than I ever will be, but he managed to keep his humor, his humanity in front of people all the time, and like Charles Jordan, managed to keep people engaged in their own lives. We are talking about two different people here, but they shared a very common approach, and they share a very common approach. They managed to keep people together and work very hard to make sure that their community was going to be better. Rob Ingram, I was hoping that he would move along to do a number of other things. We really had an opportunity. He did a lot while he was here. He had a lot more he could give but he gave as much as he could. So, again, I appreciate you letting me speak before this committee on Rob Ingram, and I hope that you pass this resolution. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative. Any questions? Okay, we'll let you get back to your other duties, and thank you for bringing both of these forward. So I think we'll keep going on Senate Concurrent Resolution
8. You're in 8.
Oh, I had opened both of them, so yeah, I think we can, yeah. So I think, why don't we call the witnesses on SCR 7? We still don't have Senator Shields with us, and hopefully he will be here by the time we get to SCR 8. So I'll call Ty Schufferman and Mike Abbott. And you're here to talk about Charles Jordan, and if you could just introduce yourselves for the record and then go ahead and tell us.
Hi, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. My name is Ty Schwaffenman. I'm the health equity organizer for the Urban League of Portland. I don't have a lot to say about Charles Jordan, but I have interacted with him a few times in my life, and especially at Reflections, which is a coffee shop where many folks in our community gather. And he was often there on the weekends and just hanging out. And, you know, he occasionally approached me and, you know, just dropped some amazing little tidbits of wisdom, and I just really appreciated everything he said to me, and I remember them to this day. He is also just a very dedicated member of his church, Bethel AME, and, you know, whenever I went there to visit, I often would try to avoid sitting behind him because he was so tall. You really wouldn't be able to see over the top of him. But, you know, his whole family, you know, they're such amazing folks and just great examples of citizenship in our community. And then would just encourage the committee to pass a resolution and hope that it's read on the floor on the 19th. We're expecting to have around 200 African Americans and allies to the Capitol on that day, and it would be fitting to hear an honor to both of these men. Thanks.
Great, thank you. And I think that is our plan in terms of timing. So,
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, my name is Mike Abate. I have the privilege of being the director of Portland Parks and Recreation, and it's my great pleasure to testify today. Thank you for the invitation. Charles Jordan was director of Portland Parks for 14 years, and during that time, he brought 44 new parks and natural areas into our system. And when you think about it, we have a total of about 200. So nearly 20% or over 20% of our entire system owes a debt of gratitude to Charles. But Charles wasn't really about places. He was mostly about people. More than any other director, Charles created a unique sense of family among the 450 Portland Parks employees, permanent employees, and 2,500 part-time employees. He was certainly an advocate of parks and the power that parks have to transform individuals and then communities. Charles often said about parks and recreation, they're more than fun and games. He knew that there was something deeper at work. Charles Jordan was awarded the Honorable Cornelius Pugsley Medal by the American Academy of Parks and Recreation Administration in 1995. And this prestigious award recognizes outstanding contributions to the promotion and development of public parks in the United States. Okay, it's just an award, right? Well, but maybe some of the other winners of the awards will get your attention. How about Lady Bird Johnson, Stuart Udall, Frederick Law Olmsted Jr., and the first director of the National Park Service, Stephen Mather. It was Charles' passionate leadership that resulted in an amazing park system that Portland has today. It was his work that served as a foundation for us last year to win the gold medal as the best parks and recreation system in the entire United States. We owe, again, a debt of gratitude to Charles' great work. But he didn't just work on transforming parks and politics. He set about to transform the entire parks and recreation profession so that it better represented the communities that it served. In 2001, he was awarded an honorary doctorate degree from the University of Vermont. The citation for the award stated, You spent your early part of your life in segregated rural Texas, unable to enjoy the basic freedoms of your white peers. You once said that you could have been bitter, but instead you chose to be better. Indeed, you expanded this personal choice into a move toward changing the landscape of the country. You are a bold and visionary leader in the area of parks and recreation. You broadened the agenda of the environmental movement and land conservation to make it more inclusive to all members of our national community. You are nationally recognized for your refreshing and groundbreaking approach to putting people, particularly people of color, at the heart of the American conservation movement. I must say, it is an incredible honor to follow in the very large footsteps of this giant of a man who showed us all what it means to be a servant leader. In recognition of Charles' amazing accomplishments and achievements, we this summer renamed a community center in his honor. And I was there yesterday with about 300 Portland Parks and Recreation employees as his son Dion gave an incredible motivational speech about the power of parks and recreation to our employees. He represents, Charles does, the very best in public service. Portland Parks and Recreation enthusiastically supports this resolution and want to give particular thanks to Senator Shields, Representative Frederick, and Speaker Kotek for co-sponsoring this resolution. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for these good folks? Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And I think this point we're probably I think we're ready to act on Senate Concurrent Resolution 7 since we're actually in a work session on it, and Senator Shields has communicated with me that he's still tied up, so he may join us shortly, but I think we can go ahead in a work session and move the amendment into SCR 7 and move it to the floor.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 7 as amended to the floor. Well, do we have to do the amendment first?
Yeah, we have a dash one.
I move that we adopt the dash one amendment dated February 12,
2013. Thank you. Senator Farrioli has moved the dash one amendment to SCR 7 into the resolution. Is there any discussion on the amendment?
And Madam Chair, the amendment merely mentions the community center. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Great. Any objection to the amendment? Amendment is adopted. And Senator Farrioli.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate Concurrent Resolution 7 is amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farrioli has moved SCR 7 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion?
No.
Okay, motion carries. And we will ask Senator Shields to carry this on the floor. And I'll close the work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 7. And we are still open on SCR 8. And so we've got several people here to testify. I think Ty is signed up again on this, and I don't want to mangle your name again, so I'm going to listen to you say it the second time, and I'll get it right. And then we also have Dana Ingram and Millel Hobbs. And did you have anybody else that you wanted to have just sit with you? Even if they don't want to talk, it would be fine to have them come forward. So, good morning. Welcome to our committee, and thanks for waiting so patiently. We do things in strange and mysterious ways sometimes here in the legislature. But thank you for being here. And whichever of you would like to go first, we'll Ty, if you
mine's very short and sweet. But Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, I'm here just to testify in support of Senate Resolution 7. My name, again, is Ty Schwafferman, health equity organizer with the Urban League of Portland. I really don't see any better opportunity to just honor such a great man. I mean, Rob was a member of the Young Professionals of Portland, Urban League of Portland, and I was a member of the, you know, Young Professionals as well, and his leadership was just so dynamic. I just remember all of the times where we worked together, worked through a number of issues together, and even just a few weeks before his passing, had been working on some major projects. And so it was very tragic hearing the news. I would just say Rob is an individual who inspired a lot of young men to really look at themselves and how we can commit to our community through service. I was also inspired by him to become a big brother through Big Brothers Big Sisters, and you know, would often see him at all the Big Brothers events. And so, you know, I had a lot of different multiple relationships with Rob. It's, you know, again, fitting that we're honoring him on Our Voices United Legislative Day on the 19th. And so, you know, we really thank you for hearing this resolution today.
Thank you for being with us. And welcome to the Senate Rules Committee. If you could just say your name and then...
Sure. Thank you for having me. My name is Dana Ingram. I am the widow of Robert Ingram, and I'm here with two of our five children, Kai and Naj, here today. Thank you, Chair and committee members, again, for having me. I also want to thank Representative Frederick and Senator Shields. I have read over the resolution, and definitely every word in there is fitting to what my husband has done. He has given tirelessly to the community, reaching out to gang members, to young professionals. He was the president of the Urban League Young Professionals, along with sitting on various boards. He's received many accolades and recognitions after his death, before his death, and I think they're all deserving. As a family, he's been at the forefront of our efforts and our passion representing our community, like I say, tirelessly. I definitely appreciate you all in recognizing him and what he's done for us as a community. Thank you. Thank you very much. It does mean a lot to my children, the passing of this amendment. So I hope that you do pass that. Thank you.
Thank you
very
much.
My name is Milele Hobbs. I am Robert Ingram's mother. To the chair and the committee, I thank you very much, even just for hearing this resolution. Of course, my perspective on Rob's life is different from almost everybody else's. But I can say that I am so proud of the man that he became. And I can tell you for a fact that he, in my opinion, and those of all of the social work books I studied throughout my education, is proof that with the right fodder, with the right support, with the right help, you can change. Robert was born. I had uterine cancer my whole pregnancy. They said he wouldn't make it. He made it. I was a single mom from the time he was 9 months old. We weren't supposed to make it. We made it. I attended college in Fresno. We lived in one of the most gang-infested areas in the country. He didn't become a gang member. And all of those adversities, he turned them into what would be the fuel to push him forward. And I believe that your passing of this resolution now is another tool that we can use to help other young people, not just in Portland, but throughout the state, understand that no matter what people or things and conditions look like they're against you, you can always win if you stay focused and put the energy in. That's what my son's life was about. That's why any given day of the week, if he got a call, he was on his way to help support families and youth throughout the state of Oregon. And I believe this type of resolution gives us a tool that we can use to help continue to develop the potential that's within our state, in our children, in our young people. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? So, and I see that Senator Shields is on his way. I bet he's running from the third floor right now. So Let me just take this opportunity to say, Mrs. Hobbs and Mrs. Ingram, that I didn't have the opportunity to know Rob, but I feel like from reading about him over so many months and just the incredible contribution that he made to Portland and to the entire state of Oregon, I feel like I knew him. I feel like I knew your dad. I wish I had. When I was listening to the President's State of the Union speech last night and then thinking about Rob Ingram, I thought he's exactly the kind of person that the President was talking about as a father and as a role model for young people. And so I think we all can be proud, but you especially can be extremely proud that he lived the kind of life that I think any of us would be really, really treasured to have in our world. And it's hard to hear about it because he was taken from us so much too soon.
Yes.
But I think his memory will live on, and this resolution is a small thing that we can do here to help further his memory and his great work. So you all should be very proud.
Thank you.
And Senator Shields is being held captive upstairs in another committee. I'm sure he would want to be here. So thank you very much for being here today. And I don't know if you'll be able to join us on Tuesday, but you certainly would be welcome when we have our Senate floor session at 11 in the morning to be here. So we'd make a place for you. And
All right.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we are in a work session, and Senator Farioli, I feel a motion coming on.
Madam Chair, I move the Senate concur Resolution 8 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farioli has moved SCR 8 to the floor with the be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion,
Madam
Senator
Chair?
Farioli?
I don't know if anybody's made this clear on both Senate concurrent Resolution 7 and Senate concurrent Resolution 8, but it is the highest honor that the Senate can bestow on a civilian. So we think it's a small thing to do only in comparison with the contribution, the life contributions that have been made by these two men. So that, Madam Chair, leads us to a vote, I believe.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. I did also want to mention, and I think that I see Molly Nguyen from the City of Portland in the room. There is testimony on the letterhead of Mayor Charlie Hales from Antoinette Edwards, the director of the Office of Youth Violence Prevention, and so that is part of our record, and I'll definitely make sure that this gets to the floor. So thank you, Senator Farioli. Any further discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? The motion carries, and we will ask Senator Shields to carry this on Tuesday on the floor. And thank you very much, everyone, for being here.
Thank
committee,
you.
I will close the work session. Did I already do that on SCR 8? And members with nothing further to come before us today, we are adjourned.